You are listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Goodnick. This week on The Mystical Positivist, co-host Rob Schmidt and I converse in the studio with Arnaud Delorme, PhD, currently a research scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences in Petaluma, California. Dr. Delorme has a keen interest in the scientific study of consciousness and spirituality. He's a long-term Zen meditator and has studied brain dynamical changes underlying extraordinary states of consciousness as experienced during meditation and due to the effects of psychoactive agents.
We'll get started with that conversation after a short musical break. Musical interludes on today's shows are from a CD called On a Cold Winter's Day from the Quadriga Consort. The piece we'll hear now is an Irish traditional piece known as Tune Number 176 by Turlough O'Carolan.
This is The Mystical Positivist, a radio show dedicated to the application of reason. This is The Mystical Positivist, a radio show dedicated to the application of reason in the pursuit of spiritual practice and development. It consists of commentary, book reviews, interviews, and discussion in and around the larger and local spiritual community. The thesis of the show is that rationality is in no way the antithesis of deep mystical experience. In fact, we assert that it is a necessary ally. This is your host, Stuart Goodnick. Joining me in the studio is my co-host, Dr. Rob Schmidt, director of Taiyu Meditation Center and co-founder with myself and Jim Wilson of Many Rivers Books and Tea in Sebastopol.
Great to be here as ever.
This week, our guest in the studio is Arnaud Delorme, PhD, currently a research scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences in Petaluma, California, and a CNRS principal investigator in Toulouse, France, as well as a faculty project scientist at the University of San Diego, California. In 2000, Dr. Delorme completed his PhD thesis on visual categorization in humans, monkeys, and machines. Based on the results of his modeling work, he co-created with Simon Thorpe the SpikeNet technology company, now a successful startup. Dr. Delorme then moved to the Salk Institute for a postdoc with Terry Sajnowski and Francis Crick's laboratory, where he focused on statistical analysis of electroencephalographic, or EEG, signal recorded during various cognitive tasks. He developed the free EEG Lab software for advanced analysis of EEG signals in collaboration with Scott McKeague, software which is now amongst the most used software in EEG research worldwide. He was awarded a Betancourt Schuller Young Investigator Award for a 10-year anniversary A&T Young Investigator and a 10-year anniversary A&T Young Investigator Award for his contributions to the field of EEG research. Dr. Delorme has a keen interest in the scientific study of consciousness and spirituality. He is a long-term Zen meditator and has taught in India on the neural correlates of conscious experience in a master's degree program for the Birla Institute of Technology. Starting in 2002, he has developed a strong ongoing collaboration with Dr. Rael Khan and took to look at brain dynamical changes underlying extraordinary states of consciousness as experienced during meditation and due to the effects of psychoactive agents. He is the co-director in Rishikesh, India, of the Meditation Research Institute. In 2010, he started collaborating with Dean Radin on analysis of EEG signals recorded during presentiment tasks. Dr. Arnaud Delorme, welcome to The Mystical Positivist.
Glad to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you, and we'll start, as we usually do, by asking you, as we ask all our guests, to set the picture for us. Tell us a little bit about your early experience that led to the work that that we will be discussing during most of the hour. The Stewart's biographical information mentioned that you're a Zen meditator, and I'm wondering if how early interest in that activity may have started for you in childhood or related anecdotes and personal history.
Yes, so I think the earliest I can trace that to would be like 7th grade.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the courtyard at school in France, in the suburb of Paris. Mm-hmm. I'm from Paris, mm-hmm. originally, even though I've been in the U.S. for 15 years now. And then I was wondering, okay, what am I going to do with my life? What do I want to do? And before that, I wanted to be a firefighter.
Mm-hmm.
And then it struck me in the courtyard, oh, I want to understand why I'm here. I want to understand what consciousness is. And so from that time, in that, you know, my social, cultural background, you know, if I was in India, maybe I would have been, you got to understand consciousness, okay, you become a mystic. But in the Western world, you want to understand consciousness, okay, well, you do research in consciousness. So that's where I set my path to. And so I got a bachelor in mathematics, and then I thought, well, I really need to work on the brain. So then I switched to biology, so I did both biology and math physics background. So I did both at the same time, and then I did a PhD in cognitive neuroscience. And at that time, I wasn't that interested in spirituality. I thought, you know, science had all the answers. And then in my thesis, I was exploring how neural networks could potentially become conscious, which is like the standard view for mainstream scientists. Somehow consciousness magically emerged from these neural networks. So that was part of my thesis. And then when I moved as a for a postdoc, so I did my thesis in the south of France, and then I moved for a postdoc. I thought, where do I want to go? And I thought, well, I want to go somewhere prestigious. I went to San Diego, Salk Institute, where I was with Francis Crick, who was one of the inventors of the DNA. He mm-hmm. was also interested in consciousness.
Yes.
At, you know, a later stage of his life. And so I went to this laboratory, and you're really stressed when you do your PhD, and then you have a little bit more time when you do postdoc to explore things. And I thought, well, I want to explore, you know, yoga, tai chi, you know, what is this, etc. And then so I started doing just more like, you know, a side interest, and also meditation. What is meditation? So it was like 15 years ago, even before meditation was really trendy. So I started doing that, and then so that renewed my interest in spirituality. You know, my existential, okay, so what is consciousness? And then I realized as well that science didn't, you know, there's answers science couldn't bring. Like, science can tell you how things work. It can tell you how, you know, they fit into each other.
Right.
It can't tell you why. You know, you can go why, I mean, you can go, you have the whole construct of science, you know, reductionist science, which is like, okay, you got the body and it's made of cells, and the cells are made, you know, they're living, but, you know, they're made of inanimate matter which interact molecules, etc., in a very complex way. And then the molecules are made of atoms, and then the atoms are made of quarks, etc. So it's like the reductionist view. But in the end, when you go, okay, I can understand that. Well, why is there any quarks? You know, why is there anything at all? And then science cannot possibly answer that question. Why is there anything at all, except of, you know, instead of nothing. I mean, you can try to unify all the forces, etc. So that's what I realized when I started meditating. And so then I try to orient, okay, I want it with my science, so I started studying meditation, so which was why I went to India and taught in India and did lots of research in India.
What forms of meditation? You mentioned Zen meditation. Is that in a particular Zen tradition?
Yeah, so I started with a book from Meditation for Dummies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have that in our bookstore.
Exactly.
And
it's a pretty good book, actually.
It's a good book.
Yeah, and so I didn't start with a teacher or anything. And then I did lots of meditation I found on the internet, etc. And Zen, in San Diego, there was a Zen center that was not too far from my home, but was called Everyday Zen.
Mm.
And Zen is good for the scientific mind,
yeah,
because, you know, scientists like to think a lot, and so they try to figure things out. So first I started with, can never remember, I think it was like Risotto and Rinzai, so there's two types of Zen. So it's the cone type, mm-hmm, which I think is Rinzai.
Rinzai, yeah.
Yeah. And so I started with Rinzai, so I had some cones, sold a couple of cones, made me think a lot, and then I moved to more like the Soto, which I is see. Like in the school of Zen I was practicing in downtown San Diego. Interestingly, the teacher is teaching both in San Diego and Santa Rosa.
Is that what's
Ezra Beza?
Yeah, Ezra Beza. Yeah. So he was my teacher, and before him was Joko Beck.
Yes.
So she was my primary teacher. He was my secondary teacher.
I see.
And I studied in that center for several years. Did some several session retreats, and you know, they didn't have much like robes or things. You just sit and meditate, which is, and you know, whenever something comes up, you just bring it back, your mind back to your meditation.
Right. So I mean, this is interesting to me that you started meditation after you had gotten a PhD in cognitive neuroscience. And probably most of your fellow cognitive neuroscientists wouldn't have done what you did there and then pursued the direction. Do you know why? Is it because of there was some connection to that early question that you described in seventh grade that drew you to that, or is it just something that seemed to follow from the context that you were living in there in San Diego?
No, I think it stems from that original question.
Okay.
And yeah, I remember some scientific meetings and so, you know, where we had some prestigious speaker come and explain us, you know, consciousness, etc. Mm-hmm. What is consciousness? How does consciousness emerge in the brain?
Mm-hmm.
All the math, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remember asking at the very end, okay, now imagine you know how consciousness emerge, and then you have all of this written down, you know, in a big book. And, you know, it's like a very thick book, but we exactly know how consciousness works. And, you know, and I put, you know, I slapped the book, you know, imagine I slapped the book on the table. What does it tell you about yourself?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, people looked at me like I was from another planet.
Indeed.
I'm sure.
And, you know, we were like, you know, and there was my mentor and, you know, all these people. So it's just like, I don't really understand your question.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I agree with you. You know, it's like it's not the standard path for a scientist, but you know, there are a few, you know, scientists which are interested in these questions, and I do think it comes from understanding why you are here. You know,
so it's interesting that you raised this question or that you had early on this intuition of the limitation of a functional description in actually describing ultimately what is an interior experience. And I think my understanding, that's the hard problem of consciousness David Chalmers originally articulated, which is you can take a functional system and a functional description, but it doesn't, it, by its very nature, it can't actually tell you anything about what it's like to be conscious. It can maybe tell you how consciousness operates. Mm-hmm. It may even tell you conditions when consciousness is present or not, but it can't actually tell you anything about how you go from this functional arrangement or this complex system to conscious experience actually being present.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that view, although I'm not a philosopher, mm-hmm. and I personally don't like philosophy. I'm more of Zen, you know, like the Zen approach is, like, it's just thoughts, you know, mm-hmm. so it's thoughts and mental constructs. So we want consciousness to, and, you know, philosophy can certainly, you know, lead some way. I mean, I see the value in it. It's not for me.
Mm.
Mostly because I don't master it, I guess, or because whenever I caught myself thinking like that, it's just like, oh, that's, my mind is spinning on. But that's the Tibetan Buddhist, you know, that's what they do. They do rhetoric.
Yeah.
Rhetoric. So that's how they practice. So they try to.
Yeah, that's part of their practice. Mm-hmm. The other thing I guess I was interested in if you were in the Crick's laboratory, then I'm familiar with some of the work of Christoph Koch and then particularly Giulio Tononi,
mm-hmm.
in what's being called the integrative information theory of consciousness. And I'm interested, what's interesting to me, I guess, from a scientific point of view, or sort of a scientific sociological point of view, is that this thing called panpsychism, the idea that consciousness is maybe a fundamental attribute of nature, reality, just like matter and space are thought to be fundamental attributes, is gaining more currency even in some of the, what I would consider the most orthodox bastions of scientific thinking. And that's really a shift, because when I was in college, the status quo was consciousness was an epiphenomena that was a consequence or a minor illusory phenomenon that was a derivative from dynamic systems like the brain operating. But now there's a feeling like it might be something that consciousness interiority, if you will, is something that is more natural and the scientific question isn't if or it's more like when does consciousness manifest?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree with you, although I don't think I'm that optimistic. I mean, you know, in the mainstream circles, it's still consciousness is an epiphenomenon. And there were some shifts, like, you know, like, for instance, Christoph Koch, you mentioned, was like the hardcore, you know, consciousness. Like, he was the consciousness star of the, you know, year 2000. And he was, like, very hardcore, you know, like, consciousness, just an epiphenomenon, it's just an illusion, doesn't exist. And he flipped 2 years ago. You know, he's like, now he's like, oh, yeah, consciousness emerged from the internet. And
yeah, he's saying, yeah, your iPhone could be conscious, maybe.
Yeah, and same kind of thing for Bernard Bohr, which, like, a philosopher, you know, was very mainstream philosophy, consciousness is just an illusion, and now is going to the conference on science and non-duality.
Right.
Still, I mean, like, I personally believe in panpsychism, and I think that's a lot of people at IONS, you know, would share that view. Consciousness is just a property of the world,
right.
Like time and space. Although I would probably argue that time and space emerge from consciousness, because these are not just concept we make up, but right. know, that's more philosophical.
So there is some philosophy in there.
And so about Tononi, you know, and still the view, I think the main view of Tononi is consciousness emerges from super complex system.
Well, I mean, my understanding is there's a panpsychic element in the sense that consciousness is latent. it's latent in all systems, or it's potential in all systems. So it's, I mean, that is a step. I mean, that is a step beyond epiphenomenalism. But it's an interesting model that if you have a system that's complex enough, such that the unity of the complexity has there's greater complexity of the unity together than there is of the parts taken separately, that mm-hmm. then and only then do you begin to get the expression of consciousness, which I think is, looking at an orthodox scientific point of view, I think that's great. That's a step forward. From a spiritual point of view, I suspect that we would be in agreement that yes, it's a step forward, but it's actually still somewhat reductionistic, because it basically still tries to physicalize the existence of mm-hmm. consciousness to complex systems like brains, and would argue that without the brain, consciousness doesn't exist.
Yeah, I mean, I don't personally have a problem with the physicalist view, because at least from my belief system, or it's more like, you know, it's not like matter emerges of consciousness or consciousness emerges of matter. It's just like, okay, it's all there, you know. And so, but my problem with this specific theory is that it seems that consciousness would emerge in super complex system, and then you have, you know, the Buddhist monk, I mean, you know, when they report states of pure consciousness, is like, is nothing. I mean, there's no complexity. So, you know, so what? So, you know, so you would have like this, you know, like formalization where, you know, oh, to achieve pure state of consciousness, you need to achieve the maximum complexity. And then you would have this, you know, contrasting with the Buddhist monk was in this pure state, and there is no complexity. There is nothing, you know. So that's the clash I personally see. But also, you know, I want to be convinced. You know, I'm open to other arguments.
Well, I mean, what the question that arises in my mind is what your research then tells us about mm-hmm. What's going on, because in the biographical material that Stuart read, it sounds as if you've done some work with meditators, with EEG and possibly other measurements of what's trying to understand what's physically mm-hmm. or physiologically happening in brain systems. So what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I mean, so I've done a lot of work on meditation, and I do believe there's some value to that, especially I'm interested in building some neurofeedback system that helps people meditating, mm-hmm. because we're kind of lazy in the Western society, you know, we don't want to meditate. I'm lazy, and I just want a machine that...
You just want to plug your brain in?
Yeah, it's going to help me meditate. I don't have to do much effort. And so I see some value to that. But, you know, I also realize, okay, you know, I do all these great studies on meditation. And I show, for instance, I did the first study that was based on pure introspection. So I just think we ask this person, just press a button whenever you've stopped meditating. Okay, and then we look at before they press the button, and then we showed, oh, okay, if we take a random time when they're meditating and the time before they press the button, so they're just there doing nothing, the only difference is that later they're going to press a button, and so there is no difference between, you know, their state at time at specific time. But we showed there's some difference in brain activity, like when they're going to press a button in the future, which means they were thinking about something else, they were not meditating, mm-hmm. we found some difference in the brain. So it was like the first article where it was purely subjective, like the person is just staying there doing nothing, and then, you know, from the external perspective you see them, you just do nothing, but sometimes they're going to report in the future, oh, I was mind wandering at the time, I was thinking of something else, I was not meditating, mm-hmm. and sometimes they're just meditating. So it has some value in the sense that it shows, oh, these subjective states are real, to some extent, which was not the case in the 1990s or even 1980s, where behaviorists were like, oh, the brain is a black box, you know, there's no cognitive states, there's nothing, you know, it's like in and out. So there is some advance to that, but at the same time, it's also, oh, this person is meditating, we see that area lights up in their brain. Great. Okay. But, you know,
it is a distinct, there's a distinct signature, right?
There's a distinct signature, but I see a lot of limitations to that, and that's why I'm not necessarily interested in continuing to just like, okay, we study, like, for instance, in India, we had 100 meditators. They were doing 4 different traditions, and we compared and contrasted the traditions to see what was common to them, and we found some commonalities, etc.
I'm actually sort of interested in what differences you found.
Well, we found mostly, it was brainwave analysis, and we had 64 channels. So the story in India is interesting because we basically, there's this ashram in India, and they just bought some equipment, EEG equipment, expensive EEG equipment, like $30,000, $40,000.
Is that Isha Foundation?
It's not the Isha Foundation. I've worked with the Isha Foundation as well. It was like, it was the ashram of Swami Rama originally, and then Swami Veda after he passed. And they're always very interested in science. So they bought this equipment, and they were like, what are we going to do with it? We got this fancy equipment. We don't know what to do with it. And so we contacted, you know, a friend of mine, and then he contacted me, and we said, well, you know, we can try to do something. And so we applied for grants, got some grants, went to India, sent one of my PhD students in India. We recorded lots of data, and so did this compare and contrast study, which was needed at the time because the problem in the scientific literature is that everybody says, oh, I found this when people are meditating. And then Zizonga says, no, I found this when they're meditating. And of course, they're talking about different meditation techniques. This one uses Vipassana, this one uses the Tibetan tradition, this one uses transcendental meditation. And so we were interested in, okay, what is, you know, we're just not going to consider that meditation in one thing. We're going to consider a different. And so we studied 3 different traditions. And we studied control, and so we found mainly in terms of brain waves, when they are meditating, we found some difference in the high frequency bands. And we have some hypothesis for that, and then we also found some difference in the 10 hertz frequency band, which is called the alpha. So the high frequency means more high gamma, and then the 10 hertz, so 10 oscillations per second for Vipassana specifically. This might have something to do with their meditation technique. And so what I wanted to say about these studies is that these are, you know, studies, great studies, but from my perspective, and I like to read them, somebody else can do it. Because it just tells you, okay, the brain lights up when you do this meditation, which is okay, that's cool, but you know, it's just like there is more we can do. And so my work at ION still with meditators and is more to study the nature of consciousness.
Got it. Yeah. You're listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Goodnick. This week on The Mystical Positivist, co-host Rob Schmidt and I converse in the studio with Arnaud Delorme, PhD, currently a research scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences in Petaluma, California. Dr. Delorme has a keen interest in the scientific study of consciousness and spirituality. He's a long-term Zen meditator and has studied brain dynamical changes underlying extraordinary states of consciousness as experienced during meditation and due to the effects of psychoactive agents. So, when you mentioned some of the work that you're doing with ions and really, you know, where the work is taking you, I've seen some of the papers that you've produced where, in a way, you're looking at applied aspects of what do you do with these, like a state of meditation, and what does that say about well-being and things like that. So I'm interested, you know, where do you take, where do you graduate from when you no longer are just looking at, let's say, the phenomenology of areas of the brain light up when someone's meditating? What's the question that interests you as a next step?
So the work on ions is more linked to, you know, the hypothesis and, you know, that panpsychism, consciousness is everywhere. And we take it, I mean, even though, you know, we believe in the hypothesis, we take it as a scientific hypothesis and like, okay, can we try to advance that using the scientific method?
Right.
Because the scientific method, you know, is just sets of tools and statistics. And so as long as, you know, you can do experiments and they can be reproduced, you know, there's no taboo or thing you shouldn't be able to do with science. You know, some people say, oh, this is pseudoscience. Well, no, I'm sorry. If you have the right tools and, you know, you use them properly, you know, and you can ask any question you want. And, you know, maybe there's some question, you know, to which you cannot get answered with science. But, you know, when you do an experiment and you ask specific hypothesis, before your priors are met, you know, you can try to answer that question with the tools of science. And the specific question is, I'm interested in answering is consciousness non-local?
Mm-hmm.
Because consciousness is non-local, that's a step forward, okay, towards the, you know, demonstrating the panpsychism, you know, theory.
Well, it actually goes a little bit further in that, as we said, flavors of panpsychism, like the current one that folks like Christoph Koch or Tononi are advocating, is highly local because it's localized. Well,
I think it would be good here to actually for our listeners to define what you guys mean by local versus non-local, consciousness being local or non-local. I think I know what you mean, but just to be clear, what does that mean, that terminology?
So, I mean, consciousness local is consciousness being in the brain or in the cell phone or on the internet, you know, like implemented in matter with little ways to, you know, transfer to our system. And then consciousness global would mean like, okay, you know, a stone, it's conscious. You just don't have access to its consciousness. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the main difference. Would you agree on that?
Yeah, I would. I guess my sense is, based off of some of your research, is that consciousness being non-local also means that consciousness can be present in outside of, let's say, a brain system, or there can be interactions or manifestations of consciousness, you know, where my consciousness affects either another consciousness or another conscious system or a physical system without a so-called physical, you know, a traditional physical mechanism. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, and I mean, what I would add is, I mean, one of my, from my perspective, the panpsychism that, you know, would, you know, where everything is conscious is more elegant, because, I mean, in physics, you want to find the, you know, to merge all the forces and everything, and, you know, and then in the Big Bang, everything merged, time, space, matter, everything, consciousness as well, you know. So anyway, we're trying to address, you know, that question. Can we show non-locality of consciousness? And maybe we can't, you know. But we try to do experiments, and it's not because an experiment fails that, you know, it shows that it's not possible. Like, the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence, you know. It's like a lot of scientific papers make that mistake. Oh, I wasn't able to show this. It means it doesn't exist. Well, no, if you have to ask, you know, the proper statistical questions that you want to answer. When you're not able to show something, doesn't show it doesn't exist. So for this, my approach was, okay, if I look at the field of parapsychology, what looks like the most promising area? And so the area that looked the most promising and was based on all the work from Gary Schwartz at University of Arizona on mediums. You know, he published a double-blind paper showing all mediums are above chance, etc. So we submitted a grant, and we got some funds to study mediumship. And the way we did it, we did several experiments. The latest one is an experiment where we have... So we asked mediums to sit in front of a computer screen, and then they just they see an image, and they just have to press a button, okay, this person is alive, or this person is deceased. And so... And the reason we did that is that in previous experiments we were doing readings. It's hard to assess because when you really want to show something in science, you need a lot of what we call trials. So you need to do a lot of readings.
Right.
And it's just not very practical to get 100 readings from a medium. With the image, it's easier. We just ask them image. So we had 404 pictures. And then the advantage with 404 pictures is that even if they're 50% of the picture were of deceased people, and 50% of the pictures were of people who were still alive.
Just out of curiosity, yeah. Do the mediums know that 50-50 split?
The mediums, did we tell them? I think we mentioned there about half of them are of, but some mediums they said, 90% are deceased and 10% are alive.
Got it.
It's only one though, and so they see the pictures and they press the button. And then the advantage of doing that with a lot of pictures is that then we can do powerful statistics.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, this mediums, you know, they classified like 300 as alive. And, you know, so they're just 75%, 300 correctly and then 100 incorrectly.
Mm-hmm.
They're just 75%. But, you know, the odds of this happening by chance is so low.
Right.
And we got one medium that was 73%, I think.
Hmm.
And so we got 12 mediums, and they came to the lab. And you could say, oh, you know, it might be how you choose the picture. Maybe you choose the picture properly, you know, because the problem is that if you grab picture on the internet from, you know, random pictures, like from pictures of people who are deceased and people who are pictures who are alive, well, the picture of people who are deceased, they're going to be posted by the relatives, etc. And maybe these people, they're going to look a little bit from far away, a bit more sad, you know, maybe they're going to look a specific way. Mm-hmm. Why? Because the picture was chosen, even though the picture was taken earlier, it was chosen after, you mm-hmm. know, and it represented their grief, and maybe it's different for a picture of alive people. So the way we did it, so we had three databases, and one of the database was, for instance, from school pictures. So mm-hmm. pictures from the 1960s, and, you know, just portraits. Black and white,
like high school graduation pictures, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but yeah. Portraits, and then what we did is that I designed a software where we said, okay, this person looks like that age. This person has this color of hair, dark means it was black and white, so dark. Or mm-hmm. and then this person is looking straight at the camera, and this person is smiling, and this person is white, and you know, and so then we had. Three raters, so three people were just categorizing all the pictures. Mm-hmm. And then we built another computer program that just like balanced the two categories, saying, okay, there's as many people smiling here for the people alive and the people who are not alive. And there's as many people who were male and female, etc. So we had nine different categories.
Wow, cool.
And so that's how we did it. And in the end, we found some results which were beyond what you would expect by chance. On the 404 pictures, we had five mediums which were independently producing odds better than chance out of the 12. And then we had overall the 12 mediums. There was only one medium at 49%. All the ones were above 50%.
And what if you took the aggregate results? What was the p-value of the?
The p-value, I think, was 0.00, so 0.005, so 0.5%.
Zero.
So odds against chance of 1 in 200.
Yeah, and that which is above what is normal.
Yeah, the threshold is 1 in 20 usually,
right.
In
exactly.
Psychology.
Exactly.
So I mean, when we wrote the article, prime is you write an article like this, nobody's going to publish it.
Well, Ions might.
Yeah, or Ions. We don't have our own journal, and even if we did, the mainstream people wouldn't look at it. And our goal is more to influence the, you know, make a dent in the mainstream and have more people interested in that. So the way we wrote in a very conservative way. saying, you know, well, it's possible that, you know, the mediums are both chains, but it's also possible that these images contain some extent, even though they were taken a long time ago, some cues as the longevity of these people. So now the medium can predict whether they're going to be dead or not, and the medium are just very sensitive to this type of information. So we didn't rule any conventional hypothesis, and anyway, we couldn't with this specific experiment. But
I'm curious, would it be meaningful to have a control where you have non-mediums looking at the same group?
Yeah, it would be very interesting to have non-medium looking at the same group and show that mediums are extremely sensitive to and able more better than control to do this kind of task. But I mean, we are more aiming at the non-conventional explanation.
Right.
So the reason I was interested in medium was that it seemed in parapsychology this was like the strongest results that there was, because there's lots of other results, but then you have to acquire incredible quantity of data.
Right.
And
I thought I saw in your CV that there was a work done where you actually were looking at the EEG signature also of the mediums when they were doing this kind of work, and that there was a differential when someone was in a mode where they were being relatively accurate, there was a differential signature than when they weren't. So that
was another experiment in which we just asked the medium, okay, we're going to give you a name. So it was double blind, for instance. You're the medium, and so I'm going to give you a name of John, for instance. I was reading for John, and I know nothing about John. But my collaborator, you know, looked for somebody that wanted to know about John. And he told me, somebody wants to know about John. So I'm asking you about John. And then the medium concentrated for 1 minute and said, okay, I'm in contact with John. And then we asked the medium like 24 questions. What was John's build? What was his hobbies? How did he pass? Tell me his birth date. Tell me the name of people who matter to him. Tell me all this kind of stuff. And so we had 24 questions, and then we had brainwaves. In the image experiments, we also had some brainwaves, and we also found some difference in the brainwave when they were correct versus incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this experiment, we had six mediums, and so we got these 24 questions, and each medium does two readings, so that's about 48 questions per medium. And on some questions they did well. We sent back the question to the people that wanted the reading. So on some questions they did well. And on some other question, they didn't do well. So we looked, okay, well, is there any difference in their brain when they're doing well compared to when they're not doing well? And we found lots of difference, and there didn't seem to be a lot of regularity across people. And but in one medium, we found a difference mostly in the frontal area, in this area right there. And what was interesting as well is that we tried to split it into more categories. Okay, on these questions, they did very well. On these questions, they did average. On these questions, they did poorly. And even that, and when we did that, we did see the trend. So the brain activity was varying kind of linearly. With respect to how well they were doing. So
in the one person or in more than
one? One person, okay. One specific person.
Okay.
In the other person, we also found some neural correlates. This one person was the one for which it made the most sense from a neurophysiological perspective, because it was activity in the frontal area, and it was in the frequency band that's called theta, about 5 hertz.
Mm-hmm.
And it's known in the literature that this kind of brain rhythm in the frontal area is most active when people are using their working memory. So, for instance, if I ask you to remember a number with two digits, you know, you're going to get this area activity. If I ask you to remember a number with four digits, I'm going to ask you again in 2 minutes. You have to remember it constantly, you know. Mm-hmm. You're going to have more activity. And the activity is proportional to, like, the length of the number I would give you. So the longer the number, the more active this brain area is. And in this specific medium, we observe that she was shutting down the activity in this brain area. Hmm. So we interpreted that, okay, she's just, like, shutting down her short-term memory. She's emptying her mind. Hmm. So this made sense from a neurophysiological perspective.
Got it.
Yeah.
Wow. Cool.
That's interesting. So from that, you certainly show something's going on, something exceptional is going mm-hmm. on. What conclusions do you think you can draw from that experiment? I mean, I guess what I'm thinking is that you can certainly say there's something happening with the medium that goes beyond our conventional understanding, but it doesn't necessarily give us a falsifiable test of the existence of, you know, consciousness beyond the grave or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, lots of people are interested in mediumship because it tells you, your spirits exist and, you know, your departed relative exists.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The way I approach it, you know, whether the mediums tap into, you know, what Jung would call the superconscious, or whether spirits exist, I don't know. You know, I'm not making any conclusion for that. For me, we can just tap into superconscious that's still showing consciousness is not local.
Right.
So I don't go in this kind of debate.
Yeah, and I appreciate that because it's certainly the case in people who have a belief system that they're trying to advocate for, and mm-hmm. you know, people who are spiritualists will look at this kind of research and say, see, here's scientific proof that our consciousness survives death, and it's certainly suggestive, mm-hmm. and the mediums are certainly operating on a particular model, but as you say, it doesn't conclusively tell you that from a scientific perspective, because there might be this vast information system that we tap into that contains the records and mm-hmm. the echo of everyone who's ever existed.
Yeah, and this whole question of, you know, consciousness surviving death is, I mean, my personal approach on it is, you know, like, your consciousness as of today doesn't survive death. You know, why? Because you're gonna go through death, which is, like, you know, a very traumatic experience probably. And so you're gonna change, you know, like people who come back from either war zone or, you know, spirit, right. like near death experience, mm-hmm. their personalities change to some extent. You know, so if you say, well, your consciousness, you know, equates your personality, will not survive death as it is right now. I mean, that's my personal belief, just because the process of dying and then your environment where your consciousness might be is going to affect your personality to some extent, your environment, etc. Even though, you know, you might still be aware, you'll be in such a different environment that you're not going to be the same person. And then there is also this other view, okay, you know, when I'm in meditation and I empty my mind, I don't see any qualitative or quantitative difference between my consciousness and your consciousness. I'm just aware now. And I'm like, okay, this other person is aware now. It's the same thing, you know. It's like I don't remember all my past, etc. right now because I've been in sensory deprivation for a week in this retreat. And so I'm just kind of this pure consciousness right now, and there is no difference between my pure consciousness and your pure consciousness. So I know this will survive my death because it's going to be another people. We're going to go meditate. So, you know, how many percent of your consciousness survived death? You know, is it 10%? Is it 50%?
Right.
Yeah, it's so that's why I don't go into. I mean, I went into the debate. But,
well, no, I appreciate the nuance on what you're describing because I think it's probably the most intellectually honest position that anyone can take. But It is interesting, you know, because I think a lot of people think of survival, meaning they want, what they really want to know is, does my egoic point of view survive death? And I suspect as a Zen meditator, you'd say, well, your consciousness doesn't survive the next 5 minutes, right?
Mm, yeah.
It's constantly changing. Mm-hmm. So to grab onto that is sort of maybe the wrong question.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I think the that's kind of what I find interesting about the work that you and Dean Radin and other folks doing this sort of thing are offering is a set of questions that don't get into these frankly tired debates that have been around now for a couple of centuries in the West at least about the nature of how consciousness might or might not survive death. Mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting, as Stuart said, there's an honesty about what we can actually more or less reliably say about these things now. And that's why this sort of work is I think interesting and deserves, you know, a broader availability. So I'm glad you're creating your papers, writing your papers in such a way that they can be published in journals that where they will get a wider readership.
Even if they don't get published in those journals.
Yeah, I mean, we get our papers rejected and you know, we don't really have good, you know, there's a lot of politics in science, you know.
Oh, like absolutely.
This editor, well, he doesn't want to edit this because then, you know, he's going to be like, oh, okay, you know, then I'm going to get in trouble for edit, you know, for publishing this. And even though he's like, oh, okay, yeah, that sounds all reasonable, you know, and so.
Yeah, that institutionalization of the dominant view that consciousness is a, you know, function of the brain, or if it's innate and panpsychic, then it's still limited to the brain, is very strongly held and enforced right now. I mean, I notice that like the TED Talks, which is sort of your pop scientism right now, excludes talks on parapsychology, which is you know, seems to me so, to go back to the term intellectual honesty, it seems so intellectually dishonest that it undermines the foundation of what they claim to be trying to do.
Yeah, and so, and parapsychology is like, it's probably, you know, the good term is because, you know, most people equate parapsychology with pseudoscience. I try to use psi research.
Yes,
but you know, it would be the same thing. There's the same thing with Wikipedia. You know, there's like this group that's called the Gorna Skeptics.
Yeah,
just go on Wikipedia, edit all the pages, and they are like a group of editor, which, you know, get like together somehow online and you know, in concord, they didn't modify the page and they bent the Wikipedia system, which is supposed to be like, you know, it's like fair editing.
Yeah, well, I've seen it just in generally what I see in the response to this kind of research in the conventional scientific community is people start with a premise, it can't be right, and they usually throw out some pabulum like extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, and extraordinary evidence means a p-value of 10 to the minus 11th or something like that, but they make these claims and then they just go through hoops trying to undermine, you know, what are the causes, you know, because this can't possibly be a phenomenon. Mm-hmm. So what are the systematic causes in the experiment? That said, it's also interesting that, you know, the research that sometimes is done, I think, was it Marilyn Schlitz did the research, mm-hmm. where she and a renowned skeptic, I think Barry Weiss.
No, it was he's in the UK. What's his name? Like the magician.
Well, she did.
Wiseman.
Yeah, Wiseman. Yeah, that's what, right. She did the experiment with that was looking at whether people could detect whether someone was staring, and they actually had a separation where the person being looked at was being looked at through a video camera, so there wasn't like physical cues. And her experiment actually showed a statistically significant effect, and her colleague in this, the skeptic, performed exactly the same experiment with the exact same protocol and got a negative result, or got a non-statistically significant result.
Yeah, and we're actually pursuing on this experiment. So there is like 2 years ago, there was like Dahl Bem, which is a... emeritus professor at Cornell University. He published this article, and you know, where he showed, all these precognition effects, etc., in a very influential scientific journal, Psychological Bulletin. It was picked up by all the media, etc. It went on TV, and the New York Times made an article about it. And so, so we're trying to reproduce that effect, adding in that, you know, like if you like the belief of the people who do the experiments. So in his original experiment, he had 100 people from students, and so we're redoing it with 640. But what we do is that we divided in sets of 20. So we have 32 times 20, that's 640. And then so every 20 is run by a different experimenter, and we test the beliefs of the experimenter to try to see if there is an effect of the belief of the experimenter on the outcome, and also to reproduce the outcome with a greater number of subjects.
So is this in progress, or have you completed this?
It's in progress. We've completed last year. We did a replication with 512 instead of 640. And we did find some results. We didn't reproduce exactly the BAM results. We were able to reproduce the results only with English participants, and we had participants from all around the world. So it worked with English participants, but not with participants for which it had been translated to other languages. So we don't really know why. We also found an effect of the... We had a different setting for the belief of the participants, but we found an effect of the belief of the experimenter and the participants on the outcome.
So there was a statistical correlation between the strength of the outcome and the belief of the experimenter.
Yeah, I think it was the belief of the participants. But we didn't find a correlation with the belief of the experimenter.
That's interesting.
And so we're trying to, with a greater end, we're also trying to influence the participants and the experimenters. And then all of our study, we do pre-registration. Because the problem is that when we publish is that people say, oh yeah, but what you did is that you had all this data, and then you went back to the data and did all this kind of analysis.
All right. You're going to keep on.
And then you're just going to find something, because you're doing so many analyses. You're doing some what's called p-hacking.
Yeah. Right.
And so we pre-register, like, whatever we're going to do, we send to your repository in the UK saying this is exactly how we're going to analyze the data. And yeah.
But we'll continue this after our break. But this is very interesting material. I'm interested to hear if you know more on the outcome of this experiment, because you're really actually teasing back some of the incredible difficulties of doing experiments of this nature if the actual beliefs of the experimenter and the participants, in fact,
affect the result. Yeah.
All right. Well, you're listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Gudnick. This week on The Mystical Positivist, co-host Rob Schmidt and I converse in the studio with Arnaud Delorme, Ph.D., currently a research scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences in Petaluma, California. Dr. Delorme has a keen interest in the scientific study of consciousness and spirituality. He is a long-term Zen meditator and has studied brain dynamical changes underlying extraordinary states of consciousness as experienced during meditation and due to the effects of psychoactive agents.
We'll return to our conversation with Arnaud Delorme after a short musical break. Musical interludes on today's show are from a CD called On a Cold Winter's Day from the Quadriga Consort. The piece we'll hear now is an Irish traditional Christmas carol sung in Gaelic called That Night in Bethlehem, mostly because I couldn't read the Gaelic.
Thank you.